Hey there, I'm Tyson Oldson. This is number 0465, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0465. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, IndyCar driver Alex Rossi is back to share his experiences on competing on the last edition of The Amazing Race. The Indianapolis 500 winner now has even more fans.
We gained a new audience and hopefully a new fan base, so being on one of the most successful reality shows definitely opens up the Verizon IndyCar series and ourselves to a whole new set of eyeballs that maybe wouldn't have watched us otherwise. So I think that we've definitely seen, you know, a little bit of crossover. In most of the autograph sessions now on race weekends, people will talk to me about The Amazing Race more than they talk to me about actually the race that's going on that weekend. So it's very interesting and a pretty cool thing, and I think overall it was very successful.
Diane Otten is the author of The Joys of Raising Boys, and she talks about dealing with how boys discuss and learn about sex.
I think both boys and girls have an interest in their bodies, and just from my own experience with boys, from the time that they are old enough to put their hand down their pants, they are interested in not only talking about their parts, touching their parts, showing their parts. I feel like boys, and could we even say adult men, have a little more obsession with their junk than the girls. I think that's probably a fair assessment. I don't know.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. During the recent heat wave, try and find a lemonade stand.
Well, it's happening an awful lot so far this summer in New York, and it doesn't seem to be an isolated story. It seems, and nobody's sure, that maybe somebody sent out a directive that all these things should be closed down, because they're really going after the kids like crazy. So it's an amazing thing that the bureaucracy and the politicians have nothing better to do than to put a kid who's selling lemonade, you know, out of business. They cite health reasons. Man, have you gone into a restaurant recently?
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0465, was Tyson Hogson, who is a Montreal-based video editor. Thank you very much, Tyson, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, you've got to give this guy a hand. A man in Florida was arrested after he managed to stab another person despite the fact he does not have arms. According to police, the man without arms has been accused of stabbing a tourist from Chicago. Miami Beach police said that 46-year-old Jonathan Crenshaw held a pair of scissors with his feet and stabbed 22-year-old Cesar Coronado just after midnight. Crenshaw, who is homeless, is known for painting on canvases in South Beach. According to the arrest report, Crenshaw said that he was lying down when Coronado approached him and punched him in the head. Crenshaw said he reacted by stabbing Coronado. After stabbing the tourist twice, the suspect fled. A friend who was traveling with Coronado disputed the suspect's account of the events. The friend said they asked Crenshaw for directions when he suddenly jumped up and stabbed Coronado in his arm. The victim was taken to hospital. Crenshaw has been charged with aggravated battery. So, an armless guy stabs a tourist and runs away. Did he still have the weapon with him? I mean, running with scissors is even more dangerous if you're holding them with your feet. A Texas police department is asking for the public's help to identify a burglary suspect who used a pair of underpants to disguise his face. The Leander Police Department posted a video to Facebook showing a suspect who appears to be a young man climbing into the Enchanted Rock and Landscape Supplies through a window. The man is clearly visible to the security camera, but a pair of underwear on his head conceals most of his face. The Post asks anyone who recognizes the underpants bandit to contact police. Oh, dear Lord. I hope that burglar listened to his mother growing up and only used clean underwear on his face when he went out. And by the way, how are the cops expecting the general public's help in identifying him? I mean, if someone can identify a burglar who masks his face with underwear, doesn't that tell a much more suspect story about the identifier rather than the burglar? Yeah. Anyway, in 2015, when Richard Salomon was promoted to city manager of Sunrise City, Florida, he said his primary concern would be to stay out of the news. Well, I just mentioned his name, so you know that promise isn't working out. Recently, Salomon tried to use a coupon to get a $3.99 mini bundt cake for free at a bakery. The coupon he presented was expired, he was told, and Salomon turned nasty, demanding the employee break the rules and give him a free cake. The employee apparently declined. This is a little bit of a black eye on us, said City Commissioner Larry Sofield. This is not what we are about at all. Commissioner Mark Douglas agrees and has called for Salomon to resign. Salomon is paid $204,000 per year. Said Sofield, I can't believe a $4 coupon has got us here today. Well, you know, there isn't a price cap on the feeling of entitlement. This story reminds me of something Marie Antoinette never said, but I digress. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, undercover detectives at the Brevard County Police Office Special Victims Unit set up a sting when a 64-year-old man offered online to pay to have sex with a 13-year-old girl. After the man described in detail what he wanted to do to the girl, a detective posing as the girl's father agreed to a meeting, and Paul Amato showed up. Okay, let's stop right there for a second, shall we? A guy thinks that he is buying sex with a 13-year-old girl from the girl's father? Okay, there are different kinds and different levels of creepy, but this one is off the charts. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yes. Detectives were quite sure it was the same man because Amato had said he was a professional Elvis Presley impersonator and he showed up in full Elvis costume. Oh, that brings new meaning to Love Me Tender, doesn't it? I hope he has one of Elvis's earlier tunes in his repertoire, Jailhouse Rock. He'll be singing that one a lot. I'm also guessing that some of his new cellmates will be singing Don't Cry Daddy, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Indy car driver Alexander Rossi is back on the show. We had him on the program back in January when he, along with fellow racer Connor Daly, were competing on the 30th season of CBS's The Amazing Race. Alex is a two-time IndyCar race winner, including the 100th running of the Indianapolis 500 in 2016, being the first rookie to win that race since 2001. He's in his third season racing for Andretti Autosport. And Alex joins us on the line via Skype from Toronto, where he's getting ready for a race right now. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. Now, when we chatted, it was, of course, after you finished doing The Amazing Race, but before it aired, so there was a lot of things you really couldn't talk about at the time. But being a competitor as you are, being an auto racer, how has being in The Amazing Race in any way, shape, or form affect your auto racing as far as from mindset is concerned? Or is it completely different?
I wouldn't say that there's any effect whatsoever in terms of driving a race car. I think the one thing that was a big benefit, which was really the sole motivation in the first place for Connor and I to go on the show, was, you know, we gained a new audience and hopefully a new fan base. So, you know, being on one of the most successful reality shows definitely opens up the Rise IndyCar series and ourselves to a whole new set of eyeballs that maybe wouldn't have watched us otherwise. So I think that we've definitely seen, you know, a little bit of crossover. At most of the autograph sessions now on race weekends, people will talk to me about the amazing race more than they talk to me about actually the race that's going on that weekend. So it's very interesting and a pretty cool thing. And I think overall it was very successful.
Okay, so going into the amazing race, I'm sure you have an idea of how you think you might do, how you might fare in various competitions. Doing the amazing race, I'm sure, is an eye-opener as well. And then later on, watching how your episodes are edited puts it into a different perspective. Talk us through those things as to how you felt going in, while you were doing it, and while you were watching it.
So yeah, you're absolutely right. So you got to remember that I think that in terms of reality shows, The Amazing Race does a really good job of not scripting anything. So everything that you're seeing that's televised is what happened. There's no second takes. There's no having production ask you to kind of react a certain way, but at the same time, some of the legs of the race were upwards of 12 hours long that they're having to condense into a 44-minute episode and share the screen time amongst, you know, a multitude of teams. So what the viewer is actually seeing is a very fragmented version of what actually happened. So that was the only weird thing, because definitely at times there were conversations and situations that could have been taken slightly out of context, but they were still all things that we definitely said and we definitely did. It's just the way that they had to cut things. You know, it was a little bit, it appeared sometimes to be a little bit different. However, I don't think that they did anyone, like they didn't try and make anyone out to be someone they weren't. So I think, again, CBS did a very good job of that. And this isn't a show where they're really trying to create villains, if you will. I mean, it's truly just how people deal with that experience in the moment.
Now, you mentioned some legs were 12 hours long. What was it like during the down times of the show? Was it just sleeping, or did you get to do anything else besides compete?
So honestly, the down times were probably the most disappointing part. So in the pit stop, so the time between legs when production had to move to their next location, it could be anywhere from 8 hours to, our longest one was actually 48 hours. And we were pretty much just kind of locked in a hotel room. Some of it was for security, obviously. They didn't want, you know, people to just be free to go roam around foreign cities. But the other part of it was, they didn't want any of the contestants to be able to talk to each other when the cameras weren't rolling, which I understand, but in the moment it's super annoying, because it's like there's these people that you've kind of developed friendships and relationships with, and when you're kind of in the hotel together, you're not allowed to speak to each other, but that's really like a nice time to kind of communicate and get to know people and kind of pass the time, but that was very strictly forbidden. So the downtime really was, you washed your clothes in the sink, you got as much rest as you could, you enjoyed the shower and the food that you were provided, and it was kind of just very much counting the minutes until you were going to be on the road again. So it was, that was, like I said, that was probably the most disappointing part, and the part that Connor and I disliked the most.
Of the various tasks that you had to do through the course of being in the Amazing Race, what did you find was the easiest for you to compete and the most difficult?
Well, the hardest was definitely the challenge that we went out on in Hong Kong. It was being able to kind of find hidden symbols that were in existing street signs and advertising. So we really struggled at that. The areas that we were really good at, which might not be a surprise to many people, is the self-driving legs. So it wasn't because we could really drive faster than anyone else, because that was a very strict, they had very strict rules, and they had security kind of following each team to make sure that they weren't speeding. But where Connor and I were able to excel, I think, is we driving didn't take like any of our mental focus, right? So we could be focused on the task at hand of navigating and trying to read street signs and everything, and we weren't really thinking about the fact that we were driving on the different side of the road or driving a car that we weren't used to. That was fine. So we made up huge amounts of time every time that we had to self-drive somewhere. And actually, I think all of the self-drive episodes we won, so that was a good thing for us.
You mentioned that Hong Kong leg. When you're sitting home watching the series as it's edited and playing out, do you sit there and like kind of pound your fist into your head going, oh, why did we do this or why did we do that?
Not really, because the Hong Kong, the way that kind of our minds worked, even when they told us the answer when we were eliminated, I was like, oh, I never would have gotten that. So we just missed the kind of philosophy that you needed to have, and it's not like we were missing something obvious. Like, we found all of the signs that we needed to pretty quickly. We were just associating them with the wrong leg of the race. So no, I actually, if I'm going to go out on any challenge in any way, that one I'm totally content with. I would still be there in July trying to figure it out. So I'm pretty good with it. I think finishing fourth was just fine for us.
You mentioned in your day job that you have new fans because you were on The Amazing Race. What about the co-competitors that you've had? I've seen some pictures. You've been hanging out with some of the people you competed against. How quickly did those friendships take place, either during or after competition on The Amazing Race?
It was really both. I mean, as much as you were competing against each other, you were also kind of sharing in a pretty unique experience with 10 other teams. But yeah, for sure, you know, two teams really stood out and were really friends with us from the beginning, and that was Chrissy and Jen, Team Extreme, I think, and then Jess and Cody. So the Big Brother couple, who actually have become really great friends of mine. They came out to the Indianapolis 500. They came out to the race in Long Beach, Texas. Like, so they've been really great supporters of kind of things that I'm doing. And yeah, I would say they're actually kind of normal friends now. And we're actually going to go, my girlfriend and I are going to go see them at the end of the year. So yeah, it's pretty cool to be able to meet people on a television show and then actually you know, have common interests and such in real life.
And how about your friendship with Connor? We know at the time that you were actually sharing an apartment because he was living at your house. How did your relationship, your friendship fare going through The Amazing Race?
Oh, totally fine. I mean, Connor and I are the same two dudes that we were. He just has his own house now. So I think we're both happier with that. And yeah, I mean, I still see Connor pretty much every other day, a couple times a week. So him and I are great friends, and it's definitely something that we reminisce about and we laugh about, because it was, like I've said, I mean, it's a very unique experience.
Were you a fan of The Amazing Race before you entered this competition, and will you now look at The Amazing Race differently after having been on it?
Honest answer, no. I wasn't a fan. I had never really watched it before I went on the show, other than kind of once I found out I was doing it for some research purposes, and I don't think I'll be watching season 31. I'm not a huge TV guy, to be honest with you. So if someone that I knew was ever on it, I'd for sure watch, and I encourage, actually a friend of mine's girlfriend was approached to do Amazing Race Canada, and I definitely told her to go do it. So I encourage people to do it if they have the opportunity. But no, it's not something that I don't think take time out of my schedule to watch.
Well, it was fun watching you race on The Amazing Race. It's fun watching you race on the IndyCar circuit. And I'm glad that at least The Amazing Race has, as you said earlier, brought some new fans to your world who might not have known who you were before you were on that show. So congratulations on those counts all the way around.
I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thanks for being on the program.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
IndyCar driver Alex Rossi, who was on the recent 30th season of The Amazing Race. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Listening to the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's finger-licking good, if you're into that sort of thing.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Joys of Raising Boys, plus Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a young British man was stabbed to death after mistakenly believing that the jacket he was wearing was stab-proof. 22-year-old Jordan Easton was sitting in the kitchen of a friend's house when he decided to try out his protective vest. Easton grabbed a knife and plunged it into the vest. Said assistant medical examiner Karen Welsh at a recent court hearing, sadly, Easton realized that the vest did not live up to its promise. Yeah. Easton was quickly taken to the hospital where he died from a single stab wound to the chest. The injuries were determined to be self-inflicted, and there is no evidence that Easton intentionally tried to hurt himself. Friends described Easton, who had only turned 22 years old 5 days before he died, as a man with a heart of gold. Easton's death was ruled as a misadventure, meaning he did not have the intention to cause his own death. Yes, a heart of gold. But he still needed connecting tissues and vessels to pump blood into that heart. This is a classic example of the Darwin file because, as listeners to this show know all too well, the tree of life is often self-pruning. A woman in Weld County, Colorado, found a baby raccoon on her property that she figured was abandoned by her mother and brought it into the house to care for it. Her family and friends found the animal friendly and would hold it and let it lick them. At this point of the story, it's important to bring up a quote by Mark Wallace, the director of the county's health department. Said Mark, "It is very important that people not touch or go near wild animals." Mark's right, especially in this case. The raccoon is rabid, and now the woman and 20 others need medical treatment for the fatal, unless quickly treated, disease. You know, this is one of those stories that straddles the boundary between being an idiot of the day and a Darwin File starter kit. The fact that now 20 people need treatment because they allowed themselves to be licked by a wild raccoon proves that their collective IQ isn't exactly on a bell curve, but rather a flat line. Anyway, police say a West Virginia man is accused of faking his own kidnapping in order to get money from his family. Monongalia County Sheriff's deputies arrested 24-year-old Preston Smith of Morgantown. Deputies say Smith allegedly sent a text message and called his brother, indicating he was being held at gunpoint and that a kidnapper was demanding $2,000 in order to release Smith. Smith's brother called the sheriff's department, and deputies who responded to a convenience store found Smith without anyone holding him against his will. Smith was charged with conspiracy and is being held on $10,000 bond at the Northern Regional Jail. Conspiracy seems to be an interesting charge since no one else appears to be involved. Also, are you hoping for what I'm hoping for, that his family didn't pay his $10,000 bail? Now that would be karma. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a passenger with a Python hidden inside an external hard drive was stopped from boarding a Florida plane headed to Barbados. Officers screening luggage at the Miami International Airport found an organic mass inside a checked bag. Transportation Security Administration spokeswoman Sari Koshetz said a bomb expert then examined the bag and discovered the live snake in the hard drive. She says the snake was obviously not an imminent terrorist threat, but its interception prevented a possible wildlife threat. The passenger was fined and the snake was taken into custody by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. His name was not released. I'm talking about the man, not the snake. Neither man nor snake made the flight. Okay, whenever you hear a story about a snake and a plane or a snake near a plane, I'm sure your mind goes immediately to that famous movie quote by Samuel L. Jackson. I'm sure you're also aware that said clip is definitely not playable on a family-rated show, so don't expect me to play it here. However, the movie Snakes on a Plane does have an edited version that plays on TV, and the dialogue from Samuel is just a little different.
Enough is enough! I have had it with these monkey-fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane! Everybody strap in! I'm about to open some freaking windows.
Monkey-fighting snakes and Monday to Friday plane? That's the best the screenwriters could come up with? Wow, what cranium filled with excrement wrote that? Ooh. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? I'm old enough to remember a show on TV with Art Linkletter called Kids Say the Darndest Things. That title speaks volumes when it comes to our next guest. Diane Otten, a professor and communications expert, is the author of The Joys of Raising Boys, The Good, the Bad, and the Hilarious. And we're here to talk about what little boys know about sex. Diane joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Diane.
Hey, Anthony. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. So when you started writing this book, basically you were taking down the quotes and thoughts that came from your two young sons, right?
Correct. It was a span of about 10 years that I kept track of all of these funny things that not only my boys say, well, the book is about my boys, but all boys say funny things. I just happen to write them down.
And how old are your sons now? We should mention your son's name are Bradley and Nate. How old are they now?
So Bradley is now 14 and Nate is now 12.
And are they still talking to you?
No, they have not gone through puberty yet, so we all still love each other around here.
Okay, no, because I'm just wondering, you know, the fact that you have taken their words and put it into a book, I also suspect that, you know, years from now, when they eventually get married, you'll be reading passages at the reception dinner.
That's already in the plan, absolutely.
So one of the things we were talking about is little boys talking about sex. And you're a communications expert and a professor, and you do have two boys, but do you find that boys generally express these things or think about these things differently than girls do?
I think both boys and girls have an interest in their bodies, and just from my own experience with boys, from the time that they are old enough to put their hand down their pants, they are interested in not only talking about their parts, touching their parts, showing their parts. I feel like boys, and could we even say adult men, Anthony, have a little more obsession with their junk than the girls? I think that's probably a fair assessment. I don't know. But, you know, it's just, I'm the only girl in my house. I'm outnumbered by all these boys. And so just watching them grow up, and I grew up in a family of all girls, so I had never been around boys before. This is all super new for me. It just was so funny, and I started sharing it on social media because just these funny things they would say and do, and then all my followers kept just saying over and over again, you have to write a book. And finally, after about 5 years of cataloging all this stuff on social media, I decided to do it.
Well, full disclosure, I grew up with four older sisters, so when I got to high school and entered the locker room for the first time, I was shocked.
I bet you were.
I was aghast at the discussions and the horseplay that went on in a locker room. It's like, really?
Yeah. And, you know, my boys now are 12 and 14, and they still walk around in their underwear and don't care and are just very, and not that girls aren't like that too. Girls, some girls may be like that, but I feel like boys are just, you know, they don't care. They're very expressive. They went to stay, for example, with my sister, Terry, a couple weeks ago in Oregon. And she begged me on the phone and she said, make sure your boys are not walking around in their underwear. They're too old for that. And I said, I'll try. And she said, I've got a plan. When they start walking around in their underwear, I'm going to go in my bedroom and take off my shirt and pants and walk around in my bra and underwear to let them know how I feel when they're in theirs.
What made you write the book in the first place, The Joys of Raising Boys?
You know, I think our world right now needs a little bit of light and laughter and fun. And this book is just, I mean, from all the reviews and the people that have read it, it's just a laugh out loud, fun, lighthearted book filled with these stories. So I felt like I wanted to add some joy to the world and be a voice that, you know, is speaking for happiness and camaraderie, and all walks of life can read this book. It's for, not really for young people, because there are some, you know, sex education stories, for example. So, but for anyone, you don't even have to have kids to read the book. In fact, the woman who wrote my foreword has no children of her own, but she loves this book and laughed through the whole thing. So I just wanted to bring something fun and light and beautiful to the world.
So I mentioned in the introduction what little boys know about sex. What are the things you discovered in writing this book, in talking to your sons and I would assume other boys and their friends and the like?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that these boys have lots of questions. And boys, and girls too, are very inquisitive. And my boys happen to know a lot about sex just because I'm a communication person. And I teach communication. My philosophy with them has always been, ask me a question, I don't care what it is, and I will answer it. So they've always asked me crazy questions about sex, about their bodies, and I've always answered the questions. So they know more than the average kid, probably. they know a lot, yeah. And I think they learn a lot from their peers, too, and I wanted to be that voice that gave them the right answers instead of them hearing all kinds of, you know, funky answers from their friends at school.
So what were the oddest things you heard them either say that they learned from their friends or asked you generally?
I think a lot of it is, you know, can you get pregnant from kissing? You know, one of them thought that you could for a long time, and I didn't even know that. And this was probably when they were maybe in third or fourth grade. They thought some girls at school who were in sixth grade, who they had heard through the grapevine, had kissed somebody, they thought they were pregnant. I'm like, that's not how it works, you know? So a lot of these boys and girls are very confused. And I think as parents, the more we can be communicative and open and willing to share with them, the better. I can read you a little excerpt if you want that short.
Please, absolutely.
You want a little funny story?
Sure, absolutely.
So this was, I actually have an appendix that's called The Teen Years. And so this is when my son was 13, so this is kind of a little older. So the title of this is When Mom Leaves Out a Key Detail About Sex Education. So I was at home grading papers on my computer, and I decided to take a break and check my social media. While I was scrolling, a post from a parent group at Bradley School popped up, and I saw that many parents were losing their minds over the upcoming 7th grade sex education curriculum due to start the next day. Nobody was specific about what they were upset about, but man, were they on fire. I decided to investigate further and sent a private message to one of my friends who was in the discussion to see what she knew. She said, you might want to check the curriculum. It's pretty major. What's the big deal? I asked. It can't be that bad. Her response, they'll be learning how to put condoms on a wooden model of a penis. Okay, that does seem like it might be a big deal. I remember learning how to put condoms on a banana in sex ed. So I get that some people might be uncomfortable with that. And then she said, that's not even the worst part. It's co-ed. Okay, now I understood. I thought about this a little bit and decided to give Bradley a heads up so he wouldn't be surprised and let him decide if he wanted to attend. When the permission slips about the week-long sex ed program had come home the week before, there was an opt-out choice. I told Bradley that I would be shocked if they talked about anything that he didn't already know, but if for any reason he felt uncomfortable, we could opt him out. Bradley came home from school a few hours later, and I called him into the kitchen for a talk. You know your sex ed curriculum starts tomorrow. Yes. Well, there are a bunch of parents who are upset about the lessons and are not allowing their kids to attend. Really? What's the big deal? Well, you'll be learning how to put condoms on. Okay, that's weird. I know. But the part that the parents are most upset about is that it's co-ed. So the girls will be there learning how to put condoms on too, so it might be kind of awkward. Why in the world would girls need to learn how to put condoms on? They don't even have a penis. I know, but think about it, Bradley. These girls may grow up and want to be intimate with a man, and maybe that man won't know how to put a condom on, so they need to learn how to put the condom on too, so they can protect themselves if necessary. That is totally creepy and gross, said Bradley. I understand, but it is what it is. The girls need to practice putting condoms on too, so you'll all be doing it together. Just try to get over the weirdness if you can. Bradley crinkled up his nose and with a worried look on his face left to go work on his homework. Over the next hour, I noticed that Bradley was walking around acting weird, wringing his hands and looking at the floor. Later, while I was in the bathroom washing my face, he came in saying that he needed to talk to me. Mom, I think I need to opt out of sex ed. Really? Okay, that's fine, but why? After taking a deep breath, Mom, I cannot have the girls practicing putting condoms on me in front of everyone in the classroom.
You know, that was, you know, as you were reading that story, that was my first thought. I think I know where this is going. Because you kind of left out a very important piece of information there.
I know. I felt so bad, too. And, you know, he does know a lot. He knows a lot about sex. We've talked about it, but definitely nothing about how to do all that stuff. And so he was really distraught over that situation.
I was thinking back to when I was in school. I had sex ed in grade 6 and also in grade 9, and it was co-ed both times.
Mm-hmm. See, it wasn't co-ed when I took it. We had a female teacher that, you know, talked about all the girls stuff, but man, they're all mixed together now. And so that also adds to the, you know, them being uncomfortable and not being willing to ask questions. So that's why I feel like for parents, it's important that we're willing to be open and talk about these things with them.
I know you wrote this book to be light and to be breezy and to be fun. And I'm sure you started writing this book a little while ago, but has any importance been put on the topic of your book in this day and age of the Me Too world?
You know, when I've been talking to some people that I've been working with on the book, and that question has come up, and I don't feel like there's a real connection. I feel like underlying a lot of the Me Too movement, and even my book too, is really looking at how boys and girls are raised. And so, I mean, I could make this really sort of long connection to that, in that, you know, the way that boys are raised, the way they're communicated to, the way they're taught to talk about women, or the way they're taught to talk to women, obviously is going to come in and affect, you know, all these different things that are going on with the Me Too movement. So it does link in with the idea that it's, as parents, it's our responsibility to model appropriate adult behavior, to model how we communicate about women and to women. So my boys, luckily, you know, we talk about this stuff all the time. They're super respectful. That, you know, I'm always trying to talk to them about these issues around the Me Too movement. So we have those open conversations as well.
Well, it's a great topic for a book. And as you said, not just for parents, it's for everybody. The book is called The Joys of Raising Boys, The Good, The Bad, and The Hilarious. Diane, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Anthony. I appreciate your time.
Diane Otten, author of The Joys of Raising Boys, The Good, The Bad, and The Hilarious. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this page, which is show number 0465, and you'll find links to Diane's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In recent years, advances in technology have greatly improved the performance of devices like cell phones and computers. Remember waiting a minute or longer for a page on a website to open? While our phones and the internet have sped up significantly, one device has slowed way down, our dishwasher. Due to government regulations, the average time it takes for a dishwasher to complete a cycle has more than doubled over the past 40 years. According to the Competitive Enterprise Institute, dishwashers used to clean a full load of filthy dishes in under an hour. But now they take an average of 2.5 hours and still often leave dishes dirty. Because of that, many consumers recently submitted testimony to the Department of Energy to, and I quote, make dishwashers great again by loosening regulations. Let's be fair, improving the performance of our dishwashers would be great. But why stop there? As one consumer said, how about making shower heads and toilets great again too? Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabbie, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And in this lazy, hazy, crazy day of summer, we do indeed talk to Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie from New York. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the hothouse of the Western Hemisphere.
I would assume on a day when it's so hot, in a period when it's so hot, when we're going through a heat wave, that it must be great for you to, you know, go to a neighborhood kid and buy a cup of lemonade.
Yeah, if you don't get arrested, or at least the seller doesn't get arrested. This kind of story, you know, pops up every once in a while. And when it pops up, most people say, well, it's an isolated incident or something or other. Some stupid cop walked over to a kid selling lemonade at a lemonade stand and made him close down or even gave him a citation because he's running a food establishment without a license. So as I say, that's like the isolated story and everybody forgets about it. Well, it's happening an awful lot so far this summer in New York, and it doesn't seem to be an isolated story. It seems, and nobody's sure, that maybe somebody sent out a directive that all these things should be closed down because they're really going after the kids like crazy. So it's an amazing thing that the bureaucracy and the politicians have nothing better to do than to put a kid who's selling lemonade, you know, out of business. They cite health reasons. Man, have you gone into a restaurant recently?
The one thing that's kind of inspiring about this story, because it's not only happening in New York, it's happening in other places as well. The major lemonade company in the United States has started a fund to help these people with their court cases against the various jurisdictions that want to put these kids out of business, which is kind of nice.
Well, you see, it's also probably the New York City Police Department trying to find busy work. And the reason for that is, as you may or may not know, they're going to legalize, to some extent, marijuana in New York City. You won't get arrested. At the worst, maybe you'll get a summons. Well, since that's the major source of arrests in New York City, our cops are really going to have nothing but time on their hands because they arrest people with the pot. Oh, man, that's an easy arrest. So, some stupid young college kid, no problem. They don't go up against the tough, you know, mafia-type, deranged serial killers. So the cops are probably figuring, gee, we can't get the kids on pot anymore. Maybe we can get them on lemonade.
Meanwhile, again, with the heat wave, one of the things that's, I guess, very important, especially if you're in an urban center like New York and you're living in, say, a high-rise of some kind, that you have air conditioning, assuming you can get to keep your electricity.
Yeah, well, we have the utility here, which is called Con Edison. They are just pure evil. There's no other way I can put it. And when I talk to you during the winter months, I always have a story for you, how on the coldest day of the year, they'll turn off somebody's electricity. And I'll be the first to tell you, hey, you owe an electric bill, you're supposed to pay your bills. But, I mean, you do it when it's biting, freezing cold outside. Well, we had a couple of days this year so far, earlier this month, where we had the hottest days of the year. The temperature was well over 100 degrees. And guess what? Con Edison didn't miss a beat. They turned off the power to those people who were late on their bills. Again, let me remind people, you're supposed to pay your bills. But, you know, have a little humanity. Pick another day. Wait until the sun is behind the clouds or something.
Yeah, I agree. Meanwhile, one of the things that has always been, not necessarily an urban legend, but something that we always heard about in New York, but a lot of us who haven't visited there haven't necessarily witnessed it, but exploding manhole covers. Is that something that's a bigger problem on hot days?
Yeah, it is. And as a matter of fact, I'm now offering on my website the Gabby Cabbie steel helmet for all visitors who may be coming to New York. Got to make a buck out of us. Well, the first thing you notice when you come to New York City is there's no electric lines. There's no telephone lines. You know, most places in the world, all that stuff is on the surface. In New York, everything, including the sewer lines, all the power lines, are everything, you know, underground. And so what happens is that tremendous heat builds up, and sometimes those covers go flying off, which is pretty spectacular. Luckily, so far this year, no one's been hurt or injured. It's just by luck. But, you know, the thing about a manhole cover, if you've ever watched how when they open it intentionally, you know, to go down and work on the wires and the cables and things, it usually takes three burly guys, you know, to kind of lift that thing up. They're probably, per square inch, the heaviest things on the face of the earth. So I don't want to scare anybody away, but if you're walking on the street and you see the manhole cover kind of rising a little bit, put on your steel helmet.
And here's your trivia question of the day, since you brought it up. Do you know why manhole covers and, of course, manholes are round?
No, but I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Yes, because it's the only shape that you cannot turn on an angle and accidentally drop down the hole.
Very good. Have you ever thought of going into this radio and television thing as a living?
And that's purely a safety reason, so that someone who's in the hole wouldn't have a manhole cover dropped on them.
Very good. And do you know why we can't say manhole cover anymore? Person hole.
Yes, exactly. Now, what's the story with firefighters when they find a parked car in their way?
I had, before I even got a chance to tell you the story, I got a sequel to the story. If you park at a fire hydrant, lots of times I'm taking tourists around, they want to run into some place. Where am I going to park? There's no place to park. Well, if you park at a fire hydrant, that's illegal. But as long as you stay in the car, the fire department doesn't really care, you know? It's almost like an illegal, legal spot. And that's a little trick I do all the time. But if you walk away from the car, you're in big trouble, because if there's a fire and they got to move their hoses, their thing is that they'll smash the windows of the car and pull the hoses through the car rather than around the car or over the car. And that's sort of like an urban legend. But I've seen it done. And I also have seen a wry smile on the fireman's face as they did it. That's sort of like, you're going to leave your car at a hydrant? Okay, this is what you get. Well, the other day, after I had written you that note about, I was going to tell you the story, I was in the supermarket and there was a bunch of firemen that were buying food for lunch, you know, to cook in the firehouse. So I said to them, I got to ask you guys a question. Is it true that you do it intentionally? And they said, no. We would never do such a mean thing. We're New York City firemen. And they turned and walked away with a slight wry smile on their face.
Absolutely. And since you, by the way, I can't leave without talking about this, since you just celebrated your big holiday, the 4th of July, I was just wondering if you decided to spend any time on your big holiday at the Statue of Liberty.
No, but most people are fit to be tied if you're referring to the lady that climbed up onto the pedestal. And the reason for that is, first of all, it's July 4th, and I mean, it's a big day for people visiting the Statue of Liberty. Also, they had to close it down. Now, you know, there were many, many people, tourists from all over, and probably a lot from every part of the world, who arranged even to be in New York on July 4th with the fireworks and everything. They all were taken off the island. I mean, the whole day came to a grinding halt. And the schmuck federal judge, can I call him a schmuck? Yeah, I'll call him a schmuck, let the girl go. And we'll speak to her again in another 2 weeks. I mean, at the very least, he should have stuck her in jail for the 2 weeks, you know, and then maybe send her the bill for closing down the statue. It was a stupid demonstration. It really was.
And to be honest, she has a very sketchy judicial past.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's that, you know, I mean, everybody immediately says left-wing, tree-hugging, commie, pinko, liberal, and all the description. But I'm separating this demonstration from the rest. This was really mean-spirited, you know, to do that to so many people. Because, look, if you have a vested interest, you have a family member who came across to the New World, that's a very exciting thing to be seeing what they saw when they entered New York Harbor. It's an emotional thing. And it was just really plain meanness. The only thing that they do that's even, well, not as mean, but almost as mean, is when they'll block traffic on the Brooklyn Bridge. That's another favorite target, which really screws up rush hour and traffic and really doesn't serve a purpose. Because I'm sure the President of the United States and our Congress don't say, oh, they closed down the Statue of Liberty, we're going to change our foreign policy.
And before we let you go, sir, I've got to ask about a celebrity sighting that you had. And it's someone who you said you were not aware of whether he was still alive or dead.
Yeah, well, I saw... This is something from my youth. I mean, everybody knows the name Stan Lee, but right. A lot of people aren't sure who and what he is. If you're, you know, of my generation, and I guess of your generation, kid, you know who Stan Lee is, and you probably grew up on Stan Lee. I'm talking to those who don't know what I'm talking about, the inventor of comics. That's what I like to call him, the inventor of comics. Well, I was on Fifth Avenue the other day, and I saw the guy, and I said to myself, it's impossible for two reasons. First of all, I thought he was dead. And second of all, the guy walking on Fifth Avenue looked about 95, which after I did some research, I found out that Stan Lee is alive, and he is 95.
Yep.
So I'm thinking to myself, did I see Stan Lee? I don't know. What a mystery. I don't usually bother celebrities when I see him, but if I had that encounter to do all over again, I would have said, are you Stan Lee? I thought you were dead.
And he's one of the people who will definitely tell you.
That he's not dead.
That he's not dead.
Anyway, everybody go out and buy a Stan Lee comic.
There you go. You're still giving tours. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is www.gabby.com. People can also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. We should mention, of course, that your taxi is air-conditioned, so don't worry about the heat if you're going to New York, correct?
Well, it is kind of, but I always like the gag of saying, would you like the air conditioning on as a surcharge?
Always a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
You got it, sweetheart. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about at a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments. I also have a few more Stuff File news stories that I want to share with you right here, right now. And a quick reminder to get my book, which is still available, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. It's got a lot of celebrity interviews in it. And those two astronauts I told you about. It's published by Bear Manor Media. It's available at the Bear Manor Media website. It's also available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. It's available in all platforms, so hardcover, softcover, and also the Kindle version. So check it out. It's waiting for you. What are you waiting for? Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Okay. An Oakland, California resident saw a black male walking around people's houses and called the police. The man was Kevin Moore, a firefighter the city council had honored a decade earlier for his bravery and heroism. He was wearing his fire department uniform, carrying a clipboard and a radio, and inspecting the vegetation. One of Moore's white colleagues said no firefighter of her race had been the subject of such a call. Local residents had been alerted, by the way, that the fire department would be inspecting their properties to make sure plants did not create an easy path for fire to spread from one house to another. Which is a good thing, because, you know, that's especially important if someone's planning to burn a cross. Just saying. And speaking of vegetation, a Wyoming city has discovered its potted plants have literally gone to pot. Officials in Powell believe pranksters planted marijuana seeds in city-owned flower pots this spring, leading unsuspecting city workers to water and care for them. City Parks and Recreation staff noticed the unauthorized greenery late last month while watering the pots, including one not far from the police station. Parks Superintendent Del Barton says workers pulled two plants on June 29th and took them to the police. Another was found a couple of days later. Barton says workers suspect there may be others. Police Chief Roy Eckert believes the clandestine cultivating is somebody's sense of humor. After learning about the weeds in the city pots, he quickly checked the planters in front of the police station. You know, sharing this story is going to give a lot of people a lot of ideas and also worry many municipalities. Also, I fear that somebody more nefarious might plant marijuana seeds in the gardens of neighbors they hate just to watch the squirming involved when authorities show up. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to the moment you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. Yes, here it is, right here, right now. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
Okay, keep in mind for this story that much of North America has been experiencing a heat wave. So places that are accustomed to the heat in the first place are also even hotter. A man in a ski mask was arrested after trying to rob a Broward, Florida bank. But 46-year-old David Licht didn't cash out as planned. In fact, he didn't make it further than the door. Police say footage shows a flannel-wearing Licht trying to open the front doors of a Wells Fargo in Hollywood, Florida. The temperatures were in the high 90s. To his dismay, the door was locked. Investigators believe the robbery was thwarted because of extra-vigilant bank employees. Here's the quote of the day from FBI Special Agent Michael Leverock. If you see someone on a balmy summer day trying to enter a bank in flannel and wearing a ski mask, you should call 911 from a safe distance. Licht is facing federal charges. Now, why, oh why, would you be walking up to a bank on a sunny day in Florida when the temperature is hovering around 100 degrees Fahrenheit and you're wearing flannel and a ski mask? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0465. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0465. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.